If you're doing any gardening this summer, chances are you're growing some herbs. In addition to being flavorful additions to foods and drinks, herbs also have a long history of being used as medicines. So for this week's Please Explain, we have asked Dr. Michael J. Ballack, director and phylicology curator of economic botany at the New York Botanical Gardens, to tell us about these useful plants. He is the author of a new book called Rodale's 21st Century Herbal, a practical guide for healthy living using nature's most powerful plants. Welcome back to our show.
Great to be here, Leonard.
And we also invite our listeners to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692, write to us on our show page at WNYC.org, or join in on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. What kinds of plants are considered to be herbs? Are they related in some way?
Well, you know, to a botanist, there are different meanings to different professions. So for a botanist, it's a plant that doesn't produce woody tissue, so it's soft tissue. To a chef, it's any of a vast number of savory or aromatic plants. Gardeners know herbs as easy-to-grow additions to their landscape. And to an herbalist or medical professional, it's a healing plant. And they range from large to small, from trees to small things growing in your garden that die back in the winter. So there's a great variety, and that's what we tried to present in the book.
And they also, different parts of them are used. You can use leaves in some cases, stalks in others, roots in others.
Correct. For ginger, for example, you eat the root, not the leaves.
And I can't see anything that ginger has in common with basil other than they are both considered herbs.
Well, they're both very powerful anti-inflammatories, so they have different kinds of compounds in them, basil in the leaves and ginger in the roots, but the net effect is to reduce inflammation, which is a very good thing.
You've done research around the world, including in Micronesia. Where have you gone and what have you learned?
Well, it turns out that all people have relationships with their environment, whether it's here in Manhattan or in some of the most remote islands of the Pacific. And we live on our environment, we depend on our environment, and we begin to learn what things are useful and harmful in the case of toxic species. So most of the work has been to answer two questions. What is the diversity of plants in these remote areas? And of the, there are about 400,000 plants that are known to be on Earth, and another, say, 60 to 80,000 that we think we haven't discovered yet. So that's the first question. What's out there? And second, what do people use it for? You know, what are its uses? What are its chemical properties? What are its medicinal properties or culinary properties? So a lot of the work I've been doing is living with pre-industrial or indigenous peoples who are somewhat disconnected from the Western world still and have a lot to lose as they begin to acculturate. And so we document the plants they're using, for what purposes, and then do research on them.
Do they tend in places like Micronesia or the Amazon to use them more for medicinal purposes, or do they use them for a full range of things to spice up foods as well?
Well, I would say that the peoples I live with mostly have diets that are heavily dependent on plants, mostly vegetarian diets with small amounts of meat or fish. So of those plants, you could estimate in any village they might be eating 30 or 40 different kinds of plants as part of their annual diet. So it's edible. I was on the island of Tana in Vanuatu a few weeks ago, and I was watching people make houses out of plants. So they were making their roofs and their walls and all of that by weaving different palms together and bamboos and using a rope made from a vine, and that's the sort of thing we were documenting.
And so I should tell you that earlier in our show, we were talking to an architect who has built bricks and a building at the Museum of Modern Art, PS1, out of mushroom and corn stalks.
Wow, I'll have to go.
In fact, the building grew. It was it's quite a fascinating thing, and now people are doing more and more work with these kind of substitutes for plastics using the cellulose of certain mushrooms and other plants. How far back does European interest in herbs as medicine go?
Well, we know that there are grave sites of Neanderthals from 60,000 years ago where one finds yarrow and marshmallow and other plants in those grave sites. Now,
when you say marshmallow, you're not talking about the thing inside of Malamars, are you?
No, no. It's a mallow that grows in marshes. Yarrow is a fascinating plant. It was used as a styptic. So when someone would get a cut or a wound, they would just tear apart the leaves and squeeze the juice on the wounds and stop the flow of blood. So it really, our knowledge of it begins about 60,000 years ago. But our first...
But along those lines, do you feel that herbal medicine is being marginalized with the adoption of Western medicine around the world? Wouldn't that still be useful today?
Well, there's something like 3 to 4 billion people, that's B with a billion people, who depend on traditional medicines, mostly plants, for some aspect of their primary health care. So that's a good proportion of the world's population. Now, when I say primary health care, I'm not talking about for the treatment of cancer or cardiovascular disease. I'm talking about fungal infections on the skin or diarrheal infections or colds and flus, things that actually can be quite fatal if they're not controlled. So I would say around the world people still depend heavily on plants for healing.
And don't some pharmaceutical companies try to find out which plants are being used in different parts of the world because they can synthesize the ingredients and come up with modern medicines?
Well, historically, that's been the case. In fact, if you were to look behind the counter where your pharmacist is and sort of start pointing at things, there's a 1 in 4 chance you'd point to a pharmaceutical that has its origins in plants. These days, lesser and lesser as technology and the procedures for developing pharmaceuticals evolve, the large companies aren't as interested as they used to be.
My guest is Dr. Michael J. Ballack, Director and Phylicology Curator of Economic Botany at the New York Botanical Garden. He is the author of a new book called Rodale's 21st Century Herbal, Practical Guide for Healthy Living Using Nature's Most Powerful Plants. It will come as no surprise that it's published by Rodale. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Traditional Chinese medicine is still widely used today, even by many people in this country. So is that one of the large cultural areas where it is still being used?
Absolutely. In fact, you can go to a hospital in China and sort of turn to the left and see a traditional healer and who uses traditional plant and other medicines, or turn to the right and see a Western-trained healer. And the medical schools in China teach both modalities.
There are restaurants in New York's Chinatowns where they serve herbal soups that are claimed to have medicinal qualities.
Correct.
Do they?
It's interesting. When we start evaluating some of the Chinese medicines, you find they're very effective. There are a lot of things that stimulate the immune system. There are a lot of things that are antiviral and will help fight flu. I'm not sure which soup you're referring to. Some of them are sort of folkloric. the shark fin, I would suppose.
No, I'm not talking about that.
The bird's nest.
I've had some soups that created tingling sensations in my mouth. They're made in a very special kind of pot that it's hard to describe. But there are restaurants that just specialize in these things. They say that they're good for your digestion, or they're good for other things to get rid of a headache or whatever. And I think only Chinese people know about them, or people who they bring to these restaurants. But it survives, and it survives right here in New York. I don't know whether Indian herbal medicine, Ayurveda, is as popular in the city, but can we find that here as well?
Yes, there are a number of Ayurvedic practitioners. And in fact, throughout cultures, we find that foods are medicines and medicines are foods. So it's not surprising that you ate a healing soup.
Was there an exchange of herbs and information about them between the Native Americans and the Europeans when they came here?
Yes, when the settlers came over, they learned a great deal from the Native Americans, and a branch of healing developed based on herbal medicine in the United States as learned from the Native American people.
We invite our listeners to call us at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We've been talking mostly about medicinal qualities of herbs, but of course we'll also talk about them as food seasoners, and we invite your calls on all of those matters. But let's take this call from John from Bay Ridge. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hey, good afternoon. I just want to tell people that the seeds of herbs are very, very tiny, and they're difficult to plant, but I've had great success with herb discs, and the seeds are actually implanted into something that looks like a coffee filter and spaced evenly, and they're really great. You just plop them in dirt, water them, and boom, you're done.
Okay, well, but are herbs difficult to grow?
Well, some of them are and some of them aren't.
Basil seems to flourish quite easily. I have thyme in my garden. I have rosemary. I have a lot of dill. In fact, dill, it just overflows the pot. So is it certain herbs that are harder to grow than others, or is it the fact that we live in a certain climate here?
Well, we have a short growing season, so growing things from seeds can be a little difficult if we have, say, a three-month season. So that's probably why you go get your basil plants at your local nursery as little plants and then put them in the pots.
Mm-hmm.
So some are harder to grow than others, but most of them are fairly easy. A lot of them really were selected from wild species that are quite resilient and tolerant to bad habitats or tough habitats like deserts, Mediterranean vegetation, less rainfall. And so they're pretty tough plants, and they're loaded with compounds that are mostly help them to adapt to stressful situations. So in general, easy to grow. I was just thinking there is something called seed balm, a seed balm, B-O-M-B, that is similar to your listener's peat pot, and only they're little circles of paper mache that have been impregnated with seeds, sometimes herbs and sometimes flowers, and you can just sort of toss them around wherever you go.
For most of us, herbs are things that we use to flavor our food. Should we also think of their medicinal qualities when we put them in a dish?
Yeah, I think that eating turmeric is really good for digestion and inflammation. The same thing with ginger, rosemary, basil, thyme. These are all very powerful anti-inflammatories that help you get better.
And people in India claim that because they eat so much turmeric, they have lower cancer rates than people in other parts of the world.
And I believe the Alzheimer rates are lower as well, and people are looking into that. But here's a simple trick. You might have chamomile tea, a tea bag at home, and after you've steeped it in hot water and let the tea bag cool down a little bit in your hand, you can plop it on your eyes to get rid of redness or puffiness, conjunctivitis. It's really quite soothing because externally, chamomile is a powerful anti-inflammatory.
We talk about herbal teas. What about tea itself? Is it an herb?
Yes. A botanist wouldn't consider it an herb because it's a woody plant. But certainly tea is a very important medicine. We use the leaves of it, and it's full of antioxidants. There are certain anti-inflammatory properties. In fact, the first whole extract pharmaceutical for external use was approved by the FDA a number of years ago for the treatment of external warts in certain areas of the body, and that was made from tea.
What kind of tea? Black tea? Green tea?
Black tea that's made into a lotion and applied to those areas.
And many people swear by green tea and claim that it has special qualities, does it?
Yes. Yes, we know that it's an immune stimulant. It's has cancer-fighting properties, antioxidant properties. The caffeine gives us a little boost. Tea is a wonderful, wonderful beverage.
Why is aloe vera, which grows quite easily on anyone's windowsill, why is it often used to treat burns?
The emollient or soothing compounds in the center of the leaf, the sort of squishy, gooey substance that when you would peel off the outside of the leaf and squeeze the inside on a burn, it heals it.
What happens to the plant when you break that leaf?
Well, you have to apologize to the plant, and you only take one leaf, and another one will grow back.
We'll take a little break, and we'll be taking listener calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. My guest is Dr. Michael J. Balick, Director and Phylicology Curator of Economic Botany at the New York Botanical Garden. His book, Rodale's 21st Century Herbal, A Practical Guide for Healthy Living Using Nature's Most Powerful Plants. Stay with us for more. And we are back with Michael J. Balick, Director and Phylicology Curator of Economic Botany at the New York Botanical Garden. His book, Rodale's 21st Century Herbal, A Practical Guide for Healthy Living Using Nature's Most Powerful Plants. What is economic botany?
Economic botany is the science of plants that are used, the study of plants that are used for economic purposes, just the things we've been talking about.
Do you do people look at the DNA of these plants to understand how they have evolved over the years?
Yes. Here at the New York Botanical Garden, we have a large program in studying molecular biology and molecular classification of plants. So similar to solving a crime, as you see on TV, DNA can be used to classify plants.
Let's take some calls. Our first caller is Jake from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Thank you so much for taking my call. I love your show.
And we love you too, Jake. What do you want to talk about?
I'm actually a do-it-yourself herbalist. I prefer to use herbs instead of a lot of medications, even just like aspirin and Tylenol are replaced with white willow. But the herb I wanted to bring up in particular was kava kava. It was made illegal in New Jersey a couple of years ago because of an unfortunate situation with a couple of teams that misused it. But kava kava, in my opinion, is one of the strongest and the most useful herbs on the market. It's advertised as a mood suppressant, but it can be used as a general relaxant, something to help with general stress, the kind of thing somebody might take some kind of antidepressant medication for. Kava kava is one of the herbs I absolutely swear by.
Dr. Balik, why is it so nice that they named it twice?
Well, the name is different wherever you are. It's a Pacific Island herb. Again, the island I've just come from, Vanuatu, is the center of origin for kava. They just call it kava out there. And there are 82 different kinds of kavas. And they have one-day kava, one-hour kava, seven-day kava, where the effects last very, very long. What's interesting about kava is that it's a great treatment for anxiety, and there are many tens of millions of Americans that struggle with anxiety. Kava has a compound that is just as efficacious as the diazepam class of drugs, the Valium kind of drug. In fact, in clinical trials, it was shown to be equal in reducing anxiety, equal to Valium, which, as we know, kind of has a stupering effect. You know, you have to be careful when you're on Valium. But this, the kava, really is a very important way of eliminating stress. But not only that, the traditional uses on these islands is bringing together the community, drinking this ritual beverage, and promoting conversation and storytelling and resolving conflict. On one island, Ponpe, where I lived, when there's a conflict, in the olden days, people would have fights and go to war. But these days, they simply pound the roots of kava, drink them in a ceremonial way, and when you're under the influence of this powerful anti-anxiety plant, you can only be friends, and you certainly resolve the situation. So, go ahead.
Well, no, finish.
Well, Jake mentioned that kava had a problem a couple of years ago and was banned in certain formulas because there were cases of liver toxicity. But of the 60 or 70 cases worldwide of liver toxicity, all of them were ascribed to mixing kava with alcohol or pharmaceutical drugs or taking a super concentrated extract. And just 3 weeks ago, the Europeans lifted the ban and declared that kava was a safe herb. And of course, we always suggest that you use herbs under the supervision of someone who's trained in healthcare, a healthcare professional.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about, because someone like Jake is rather sophisticated. The people who you stayed with who use kava have learned a lot over the years, obviously, maybe over the centuries through tradition. But can't some herbal supplements be rather dangerous if we use them, if we don't use them well, if we're not exactly sure what they do?
Yeah, that's a really good point.
And should we just check with a traditional doctor about whether it's a good idea? Some of them would be hostile to any of these.
Well, over 40 medical schools and medical centers now teach integrative medicine in the United States, and these are people who are being trained to administer modalities like herbs and vitamins and things like that that have evidence behind them and evidence for their use. But there is one other aspect that really frightens people when they read about it on the front pages of journals and magazines, and that is unscrupulous herb companies sometimes put chemicals or pharmaceutical products in their herbs, or they supercharge their herbs by making them highly concentrated. And that's a rarity, but it does cause adverse events and adverse reactions.
Let's take another call. This call is from Dr. Deepak Manvi from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air. Are you there? Okay, well, let's talk about some of the other herbs. Is garlic an herb?
Yeah, in the context of this book, garlic is in it.
Isn't it part of the onion family?
Yes, it's related to chives and onions and It's a good immunostimulant, and there is some evidence on some of the preparations that can lower cholesterol slightly. But it's a good thing to eat when you have a cold and year round.
The Chinese claim that it's their garlic that lowers cholesterol. Not all garlic does. So can garlic be different in different parts of the world?
Any herb can be different based on where it's grown, the season, the cultivar that's being used, or the variety that the local people are growing. In fact, time of day can impact the potency of the essential oils, let's say, in lavender. Picking things in the morning, you'll have a higher percentage of essential oil, whereas in the afternoon you'll have a lower percentage because it's volatile, it vaporizes.
We're going to try to put Dr. Manvi back on the air. Hi, doctor.
Hey, love your show. Can you hear me, sir?
Yes.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk about, I grew up in India and learned a lot about herbal medicine and then practice allopathic medicine and Ayurvedic medicine in Manhattan. And I wanted to talk about some of the simple things like marigold flower, and the doctor could validate that, or that when we grew up as a child and throughout my training, we used the juice of a marigold flower whenever there was an insect bite instead of jumping to a Neosporin or putting hydrocortisone on your skin and just rub the juice of the marigold flower. That would have just equal healing effect, a minor burn, a mosquito bite. The use of aloe, cactus aloe, as a sunscreen protector when you're going to the beach, things like that instead of using the chemicals.
Yes.
You want to join in, Dr. Balak?
Sure. In this book, we talk about 180 different kinds of herbs, including the ones that the doctor has mentioned. I particularly like the calendula, or the common name's pot marigold, and that's related to the marigold that you're speaking of. It's a very, very powerful anti-inflammatory, and in fact, it's incorporated into lotions and creams and those sorts of things that are meant to soothe the skin and heal insect bites and rashes and such. So I've been to India twice and studied Ayurvedic medicine. It's briefly, it's a very, very powerful and rich system that's more than 3,000 years old, and it excels in prevention, preventative medicine, as well as treatment. One of my favorite herbs from India is called ashwagandha. Do you know that one?
I don't know if he's still there.
Okay. Well, that one
not there anymore.
Is a powerful adaptogen. Now,
he is there. Do you know that one, Dr. Manvi?
Yes, it is very powerful, and it is used a lot. It is the 80-20 rule, one of the most commonest used herbs in the Ayurvedic medicine. What the doctor is referring to.
It's a powerful adaptogen, and it helps us adjust to stress in our lives. It also can be taken as a tea in the evening to sort of calm down before you go to sleep. So it's also a great immune fighter. We had an ashwagandha on exhibit here at the New York Botanical Garden last summer when we had a major exhibition devoted to medicinal plants. It's quite easy to grow. And as you know, the root is the part of the plant that's ground up and made into tea or consumed directly.
Now, when we eat dandelions, another flower interestingly, a weed, when we eat it in a salad, or when we're having thyme or dill or some of the other things that are very commonly used to flavor foods, are we also getting medicinal effects, or are the things that we tend to get at the supermarket or at a green market not the same as the ones that you would want to use to have a medicinal effect?
Well, dandelion is a very powerful diuretic. but it does not cause a lot of excretion of potassium. So it's a very good summer herb. In fact, you can chop it up, boil it in water, and sprinkle the cool water over your pet food for your pets, your dogs, for example, because it's rich in protein, potassium, vitamins, iron. It's a very, very good thing to put in your food. But getting back to the question about the markets, most of those dandelions are not harvested from the wild. They're grown, so we know that they don't have pesticides on them. They didn't come from someone's lawn where they went over it with a lawnmower and a sprayer and a fungicide. So I think those sorts of things are perfectly wonderful to eat.
Are there any others that you like a lot? St. John's wort, for example?
Well, I have my favorites.
Okay, what are your favorites? We have very little time, but we'd like to hear what they are.
Well, elderberry, for example, and that's wild in this area. The berries are great for fighting flus. They're very powerful antivirals.
Isn't echinacea a local plant?
Yes, it grows outside in my garden and many people's gardens, and that's great for stimulating the immune system. Something as simple as papaya is great for the skin. You can take the clear sap that exudes from the outside of the fruit and put it on skin irritations. But my favorite herb is chocolate, and that's 85% or higher cocoa solids, because not only does it improve mood, but it has cardiovascular protective properties and is overall a good thing to start your day with.
Michael J. Balick is director and phylicology curator of economic botany at the New York Botanical Garden. His book, Rodale's 21st Century Herbal, A Practical Guide for Healthy Living Using Nature's Most Powerful Plants, includes lots of wonderful photographs. So if you are unsure of what the herb is, you can always look it up here. This is kind of encyclopedic in its listing of different herbs, and each one illustrated. Thank you so much for being on our show today, because this has been eye-opening for me.
My pleasure. And
is there something I should be growing in my garden right now that I haven't been growing?
We're going to have a wonderful weekend, and it's time to get out to your garden and put those culinary herbs in. I put tarragon in recently, all sorts of interesting mints.
Thank you. We have to leave it there.